KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Tara Hill Spinall.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
Yorktown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll hear how San Francisco might jump ahead of the law to get injection drug users off the streets and into treatment.
All the things that people said we couldn't do because of the law, we did them here in San Francisco.
Then we'll hear a variety of perspectives about opiates from our project California Speaks, from drug abusers to doctors.
You know, I always imagine a blackout being someone passing out and waking up the next morning, when in actuality a blackout is someone going into a zombie state for up to a week and possibly going into a coma, and that seems to be happening.
Confronting the opioid crisis, coming up today on Cross Currents. In San Francisco, injection heroin is the face of the opioid crisis. With people dying in the streets, the city's looking at radical harm reduction strategies to treat addiction. Heroin is illegal, but some health workers and politicians are willing to break the law to reach addicts and get them into rehab with supervised injection sites. Reporter Claire Strempel explains.
More than 22,000 people inject drugs in San Francisco. Helder Peralta is one of them.
Yeah, in general, like, before all the drugs and all the bad stuff kicked in, pretty positive, happy, outgoing person. I actually enjoyed my life.
It's been a decade since Peralta started using drugs. When he became homeless 2 years ago, he started injecting heroin.
I've been the person in the tent, starving, not eating in 3 days.
The city wants to get people like Peralta into housing and rehab programs before it's too late. A key part of this effort is safe injection sites. They're clean, medically supervised places for drug users to shoot up. At first glance, it's counterintuitive. To make the city healthier, the plan is to provide a space for drug users to inject potentially lethal drugs. The promise is these facilities would take drug use off the streets and get users somewhere safe and clean. It sounds like a great plan to Peralta. We met at HealthRight 360, his clinic on Mission Street.
I know plenty of people that would, I've literally mentioned it two or three times, and their eyes got wide open like, yeah.
Supervised injection sites are a step beyond the harm reduction services that San Francisco already has, like clean needle exchanges and the wide availability of the overdose-reversing drug, Narcan. The goal is to save lives and reduce disease. But Peralta sees another benefit, restoring his dignity.
Not being humiliated in the street, not having to hide, not having to put a sweater over your head and with a flashlight in your mouth and trying to, yeah, it would help.
Peralta's the kind of guy supervised injection sites are supposed to help. Addicts who are ready to get clean. Walking back towards the shelter where he's staying in the Mission, he dreams of his own apartment and a job.
What's your dream job?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Giving stuff away.
So like the Oprah of Mission Street.
Yes! Oh my gosh. You get a sandwich.
Supervised injection sites are a brand new concept to Americans. They haven't been done before because they're currently illegal. San Francisco might be the first city in the United States to operate one. So most people don't know what they are. That's why activists are trying to introduce the concept at community events like the Sunday Streets Festival and the Sunset.
It's like a nice metal sterile booth where people were able to wipe it down and keep it nice and clean.
Charles Hawthorne works for the Harm Reduction Coalition. He shows me a booth that looks like a station at a hair salon, except instead of scissors and shampoo, there's needles and Narcan. It's an outlier at a street fair where families are cruising by on bikes.
There usually is some injection equipment, so it would be things like needles, ties, cookers, whatever it is they need to prepare their drug. And it's just kind of a personal space. So you can spread your stuff out. You can relax. You don't have to be sitting here rushing in the ground trying to hide it.
He makes it sound comfortable, which isn't something you usually associate with hard drugs. But making it comfortable is key to getting people to come to these places instead of shooting up in alleys. Trained staff would watch out for overdoses, teach safe injection techniques, and more importantly, connect users to treatment programs.
Mostly it also functions as a way to just kind of bring people into the healthcare system in general. They might feel isolated. They might feel left out of the system in a lot of different ways.
Harm reduction is healthcare to mitigate the damage of addiction. Advocates say harm reduction is like a seatbelt on addiction. Your seatbelt doesn't prevent a car accident, but it can save your life when you crash. San Francisco has a long history of harm reduction policies and non-judgmental medical treatment. Think Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic and Needle Exchange. Programs that cut through the stigma of drug use. But even here, a supervised injection site can be a hard sell. Hawthorne says people have strong reactions to drug use because the past 40 years of national drug policy has taught us to look down on drug users because they didn't just say no.
I think the concern people voice the most about them is they feel like it's enabling. They feel like, well, if we really were cared about people who use drugs, we'd be trying to get them to stop. We'd be trying to get them to not use. And what I usually say to that is the only thing I enable people to do is to stay alive, because dead drug users don't recover.
The Department of Public Health says about 100 people per year die from opioid overdoses in San Francisco. New research shows supervised injection sites can keep addicts out of the hospital without increasing drug use. In Vancouver, one of the cities where sites are legal, the number of injection drug users hasn't grown in the decade safe injection sites have been operating. Dr. Alex Kral conducted that study. He's with the Research Triangle Institute, a nonprofit research group.
I think the most compelling results are just that it reduces the likelihood of dying from overdose. It reduces HIV infections, hepatitis C infections, saves city money.
A lot of money. One safe injection site could save San Francisco more than $3 million a year. That's according to the study Kral published in the Drug Policy Journal. He says a designated place to inject would help solve another problem, needles on the street.
I think people are just fed up. They're like, fix it. Just fix it. If it's going to get the needles off the streets, if it's going to get folks off the street, if it's going to possibly be an opening to help someone who struggles with addiction, then let's try it.
That's Mayor-elect London Breed. She says safe injection sites didn't make sense to her at first.
First thing I thought is, that's crazy. Why would we do something like that? Why would we make it more convenient for someone to shoot up?
Policymakers see the misery of drug use right there in the streets around Civic Center on their way to work at City Hall. It's a daily reminder of where their efforts fall short. So San Francisco politicians are ready to take risks. For example, supervised injection sites break almost every conceivable drug law, short of selling the stuff. They violate the federal crack house statute, which bans providing a place to use drugs. Mayor-elect Breed wants the city to move ahead anyway.
I mean, it's San Francisco. You know, we operate, I think, differently from any place else in the world.
San Francisco has a track record of breaking the law first and changing the law later. Same-sex marriage, sanctuary cities, and marijuana.
You know, ultimately, I think we just need to do it and let the chips fall where they may.
Anyone running a safe injection site could be liable if the federal or state government decide to enforce the law. Healthcare providers working at such a facility could lose their medical licenses. Whole buildings could be seized. But San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon says not only will he not prosecute safe injection sites, he supports this experiment.
You know, sometimes when the laws haven't caught up with the needs of the community, we have to be bold and we have to act in a different direction.
It's the federal government that's more likely to enforce drug laws than local or state law enforcement. On the state level, there's a bill before the legislature that would allow safe injection sites in certain counties. Mayor-elect Breed says San Francisco may move ahead before that bill passes.
We've tried the illegal route for 40 years, right? We haven't seen a reduction in addictions in this country. To the contrary, we have seen a tremendous increase in the last three decades. Drugs are cheaper. They're more widely used. More people are addicted. More people are dying. So what have we done that has worked?
What's worked for Helder Peralta so far is a three-month rehab program. Supervised injection sites could connect drug users with programs like this one. Peralta tried to get clean by himself, but it never worked. This time feels different.
Scared. Worried. And excited at the same time.
Injection drugs are a notoriously hard habit to kick. Studies say about half of users relapse.
I'm worried that it might not work, that I'll fail again, just like I failed it when I was doing it by myself. And now someone's, you know, taking responsibility and going, all right, we're going to help you, and I might let them down.
He's a month in and committed to sticking with it. Meanwhile, people who work with drug users joke that the city effectively already has injection sites. BART station's downtown, and here, at the main branch of the San Francisco Public Library. We're not in the stacks, obviously. We're in the downstairs bathroom. Library guards like Nick Loya kick users out of the bathroom every day. They're not just policing drug use. They're also saving lives.
This is the intranasal Narcan.
Since a fatal overdose inside the library a couple years ago, the library decided to stock Narcan, an opioid blocker. It's kept in the security office, in the first aid kit, next to the Band-Aids. There's a metaphor here. Like a Band-Aid, Narcan is a short-term fix. It saves a life, but it doesn't cure addiction. It's not a substitute for treatment.
So it goes in the nostril, just all one shot. Just hold it like you would like a nasal spray. There's no real set time as to how long it takes for it to work. On average, I say probably between 2 and 4 minutes. Just depends on how long that person's been down for.
Loya has only been working at the library for 6 months, but he says he's had to administer Narcan 3 times already. Over 100 library staff volunteered to learn to use nasal Narcan. Librarians are effectively serving on the front lines of this public health crisis. And drug users keep coming to the library because it's safer than the street.
You're not going to get beat up in there. You're not going to, no one's going to break into a stall and steal your drugs or beat you up for whatever reason. There's security in there, and we would get kicked out on a regular basis.
Libraries are for books, not heroin. But I was curious, if Peralta had a safe place to go inject, would he be less committed to quitting drugs?
I know what you're asking, and some people could say and will say that safe injection sites are just going to cause people to automatically want to use more drugs. People don't wake up in the morning and say, I want to be a drug addict. People wake up in the morning saying, I wonder how long I'm going to live today. And if there's someone out there that's going to make it safe for you to live, hey, you know, let it be.
Local governments can start new programs to fight existing health threats without approval from the state. So London Breed could make a city-run safe injection site happen. But it's a bold move without the umbrella of protection from state law. Even so, a sanction from the mayor could allow these sites, and maybe more people like Peralta, to move forward. In San Francisco, I'm Claire Strumpel for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The statewide community project California Speaks, based here at KALW, recently asked listeners this question. How has the opioid crisis affected your community, and what should be done about it? Well, we heard from a range of people, intimate stories, deeply exploring tragedies and solutions, and we wanted to share some of them at length with you today. We'll start with a call we got from a man named Don in L.A.
Yeah, calling from a sober living, intensive outpatient treatment program. Yeah, pretty much everything I see, the worst devastation that I see is from opioids. It's mostly alcohol and pills to heroin. All the kids, man, they're all starting with Xanax. They're all starting with Klonopin and, you know, oxys or whatever the hell, these pills, and they're finding quicker ways to ingest them and get a faster and harder rush, and it's really devastating. I don't know if they're just prescribed more. I don't know how these substances are getting out in the quantities and in the ways that they are. It's shocking. I've been doing this, that, and the other thing since I was 15 years old. Used to steal Vicodin and Xanax and Percocet and stuff from our parents when we were kids. But it never was like this. I mean, not to this, to, you know, epidemic point. The thing that I see mostly, because kind of in my cup of tea, is more the uppers, like crystal meth and cocaine and stuff like that. So I haven't really paid attention to the other side of the spectrum, but I do notice when people die, and people die, these blackout sort of comas that have now become part of my vocabulary are frightening. I didn't know that that was something, that a blackout was actually an event that occurs longer than a night. You know, I always imagine a blackout being someone passing out and waking up the next morning, when in actuality a blackout is someone going into a zombie state for up to a week and possibly going into a coma. And that seems to be happening a lot, which leads to, you know, take your pick, car accidents, rapes, whatever. Yeah, something needs to be done. There needs to be more education, I think, because these kids, just like I did, you know, they just don't take it seriously enough. I think there just needs to be more education. It needs to be real. It needs to be heartfelt, not from a textbook or, you know, I mean, what's helped me in my current situation is just scaring people with their stories, you know, real, real stories from real people. There needs to be more of that, like, you know, earnest education. But something needs to be done, because this can't be overlooked anymore. All right, thank you.
That was Don calling in from L.A. Here's another perspective on the opioid crisis.
My name is Josh. I'm calling from San Francisco. The nightmare of the opioid crisis leapt out of the front pages and into my life about 3 weeks ago. A dear friend of mine had been given a party drug after work on that Thursday night. He probably thought it was ecstasy or something. He's not at all the type who would use any sort of opioid. Anyway, it was cut with fentanyl. Apparently, he died immediately. The waves of sorrow have mostly ebbed at this point for me, although they are moving through the extended community of people who loved him, and I am afraid to imagine the experience of his family and his nieces who love him so much. This is a national crisis on the scale of AIDS or Vietnam, where young lives are robbed from us in front of our eyes, robbed from us in the most horrifying way. And the pure truth of it is that this is a crisis of policy. The drug itself might as well be a virus or a bullet. It doesn't matter. What produces the casualties is policy. What produces the casualties are lying corporations that know the drugs are addictive and market them anyway. What produces the tragedies are failed government policies like our farcical war on drugs, our double standards around illegal versus legal drugs that create black markets and gangs that cross international borders and make money for private prisons and create impoverished and desperate criminalized classes that can be scapegoated and targeted by law enforcement and politicians, while the real criminals get fat paychecks and well-funded re-election bids.
That was Josh. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. And we also heard from a local physician.
Oh, hi. My name is Jason. I'm calling from San Francisco. And I just wanted to comment on the opioid crisis. I personally have had several extended family members who have been tragically affected by opiate addiction. I'm also a doctor that works in a hospital, and I would say that both inpatient and outpatient docs do bear some responsibility in contributing to the opiate crisis over the past 20 or so years. People ask me, you know, why are you guys so quick to prescribe opiates, or especially in the past, why have you been so quick to do it? And I think the answer is we want to help people who are suffering in pain. And especially in the past, opiates were a quick and easy way to do that. And I think we were probably somewhat blind to the consequences of what we are doing. I also think that there were elements of medical practice that made it easy for us to do things like prescribing these opiates on such a widespread basis. And one of those things, I think, was having drug reps. I remember in medical school that drug representatives, these are representatives from pharmaceutical companies, would buy all the medical students and residents lunch, and then while we were eating, they would come in and tell us about the newest pharmaceuticals that they had, and these included opiates. In clinics, they would give free samples, and so it was, you know, definitely a vulnerable time, both in our training and in our everyday work. And it was very easy to be influenced by that. And I think that things are being done in the medical community to decrease opiate use. Some of these things include non-opiate pain controls for patients that are coming out of the operating room. This means like using intravenous Tylenol, using nerve blocks, and in the clinic using things like acupuncture, non-narcotic types of medications, and even alternative therapies like CBD, which is a derivative of marijuana. I think the state has also helped with new prescription pads. There's a database now that tracks patients through different medical settings to see if they're shopping for opiates. And I think in a lot of medical groups and medical communities, there have been policies set to limit the amount of opiates that can be prescribed by the ER. And there's also limits on sales by drug representatives, pharmaceutical representatives. And I think these are all good things, and we need more of this. We need to make it easy to do the right thing and hard to do the wrong thing. And I think there also needs to be more widespread, systematic limits on pharmaceutical representative sales. So those are just my two cents. Thanks. Bye.
That call came in from Jason, a doctor from San Francisco. And all those voices came to us through California Speaks, a statewide call-in project based right here at KALW. There's a new question every week. Check it out at speakca.net. And that's our show. Today's Cross Currents team includes Nina Gensler-Debs, Nicholas Harder, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, True Gwynn, Celine Ross, and Marco Seiler Gonzalez. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.